Normally, the practice in academia is to send an article to two evaluators. The editor had sent it only to one, who responded, "I assume this paper is a joke.
Huh.
If it is serious, the author should be subject to prosecution for criminal malpractice."
What?
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks. Welcome one and all to the program. Glad as always to be here to be your host as we go off in search of the enigmatic like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. So let's lock in. Hope you guys are all doing well out there. And of course, a shout out to our friend, the enigmatic Hobbo, Race Hobbs, who is en route back to Arkansas. He and the lovely Lady Bird making their way home. A whole lot of folks staying at home or on their way there in these curious times. And of course, we keep hearing from all you guys out there as the pandemic threat continues. We continue to encourage communication and, of course, are always glad to hear from you guys. And tonight, we've got a special guest lined up from right here in the Carolina quarantine zone. He'll be joining us to discuss his book, Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFO. That is Professor David Halperin, who, according to his website in the 1960s, was a teenage ufologist convinced that flying saucers were real and that it was his life's mission to solve their mystery. However, having become a religious studies professor, and a man with incredible credentials in that regard, I'll just go ahead and say here at the outset, his research into this topic so many decades later has taken a different approach, which looks at the power and fascination of the UFO, which he says has nothing to do with space travel or life on other planets. It's about us, our longings, our terrors, and especially the greatest terror of all, the end of our existence, which actually ties in with what's been going on in the news lately. Dr. Halperin had reached out to me the other day, and he had read an article that I had written about the Belgian Triangle Wave and how we're seeing the 30th anniversary coincide with the pandemic and a lot of people stuck at home looking up and they're seeing UFOs. Well, they're seeing things in the sky that they can't explain, but often, as we know, a lot of these reports are the Starlink satellite constellation that Elon Musk and SpaceX put into space. As we heard last week, perhaps there are other things that have been observed in the skies, maybe Chinese lanterns and things along those lines. But anyway, I'd written an article about this, and Dr. Halperin reached out to me, and he sent me a blog post he had done there at the Stanford University Press blog titled Mortality, Myth, and the UFO. And so I'm going to have him explain a little later what he means by mortality and myth as those things relate to the UFO experience. And yes, again, we have another academic professor joining us this week to discuss his interest in the UFO phenomenon in the midst of all the trouble that the coronavirus has caused with so many professionals, with so many educators, with so many people stuck at home. It has definitely increased our time and availability for deep and exciting conversations. And for those of you guys who follow me on Instagram, Micah_Hanks, over there on Instagram, I posted a video clip the other day from a much lengthier conversation I had with, I gotta say, an individual who is truly on my bucket list. That is Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum of Idaho State University, who is an authority on paleoanthropology, but of course most listeners of this show would know Meldrum as being also one of the leading academic authorities who has taken seriously the idea of Sasquatch. And so Dr. Meldrum was kind enough to talk with me. We're going to feature some of that conversation next week on this show, but the intention behind having that conversation was twofold. One has to do with, yes, a writing project, one of many that I'm involved with right now, and also a sister podcast to this program that looks exclusively at zoological mysteries that my friends Jeff and Dakota are going to be helping with, and also Lauren and the Seven Ages guys, Jason and James, and a few others, because there are so many in this little network, this little community here in the bunker, who share a passion for those topics, paleoanthropology, cryptozoology. And so this has been a project a long time in the works that's been primarily behind the scenes. Yes, with the pandemic, things have been sort of set back. A lot of projects have been set back. But nonetheless, despite some setbacks, we are moving ahead, and we'll have more information about that exciting addition to the podcasts that I already provide in the coming weeks. So I sincerely hope you guys out there are as excited at these new prospects as I am. And actually, there are some other projects, some other irons in the fire, but we'll discuss that more a little later. First, I want to get into a bit of news right here at the outset. NASA posted an announcement at their website on April 15th, normally tax day, but this go-round, it was the day that some of us here in the United States were getting stimulus checks in the mail. So that was a nice surprise. Many are still waiting on those. Some have actually received them via direct deposit. But yeah, NASA was putting down payment on something of a different kind on April 15th. That's right. What they posted at their website is that a team of transatlantic scientists who are utilizing reanalyzed data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope has discovered an Earth-sized exoplanet orbiting in its star's habitable zone, the area around a star where, of course, a rocky planet could support liquid water. An Earth-like planet, of course, that may host life. Now, according to NASA, they say scientists discovered this planet called Kepler 1649c when looking through old observations from Kepler, which the agency retired in 2018. Now, it's not to say that they don't normally do that, but yet again, with many observatories closed, with many people having to work from home, yet again, this has provided a unique opportunity. I keep reiterating that, you know, that despite the trouble of the coronavirus situation, this has allowed some unique opportunities as well as it has placed limitations on things. And my hope, of course, is to try and highlight the positive side of things. Trust me, ladies and gents, if you read the news or if you watch TV any day of the week, you'll see all the more negative reporting. And so, of course, that can't be ignored, but I like to focus on the positive side of what's been going on right now. And so, yes, NASA scientists re-examining older data, which had been retired, I believe, in 2018, is now finding new evidence of possibly habitable planets out there. Now, they note that while previous searches with a computer algorithm misidentified it, researchers reviewing Kepler data took a second look at the signature and recognized it this time as a planet. Out of all the exoplanets found by Kepler, this distant world, located 300 light years from Earth, is the most similar, they say, to Earth, both in size and in estimated temperature. I guess we'll wait and see in the coming months and maybe even years what new information we are able to glean about this location. But yet again, it's one of those promising little areas out there in space in our ongoing search for possible life. Another real big science story this week. You know, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, that is. And apparently the theory of general relativity has yet again proven accurate, because now, following nearly three decades of monitoring, Science Mag reports that researchers have detected a subtle shift in the orbit of the closest known star to the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way, and the movement that they have observed, yet again, matches Einstein's theory, not only mostly or closely, but precisely. This star, by the way, is known as S2, and it follows an elliptical 16-year orbit, which made a close approach, that's within about 20 billion kilometers, but still close, astrophysically speaking, to our black hole, Sagittarius A, and this occurred last year. Now, if Isaac Newton's classic description of gravity holds true, they say S2 should then continue along exactly the same path through space as on its previous orbit, but it didn't. And hence, physics yields yet again to the great mind that is Albert Einstein. But when we talk about Einstein, to his credit, I'm not trying to discredit him, I'm actually trying to afford him a voice in all this. I do worry only at times that science sometimes becomes so fixated on proving everything Einstein said to be correct that they forget the fact that, of course, you know, at least for general purposes, a lot of Newtonian physics, that is, the physics of Isaac Newton, it still holds true. It still works to a point. But quite obviously, that picture is incomplete. Einstein is able to fill out more of that picture for us. But Einstein also said in his lifetime, I don't expect to be the be-all, end-all, the last word on this story. I'm sure there will be others, Einstein might have said. I'm paraphrasing, in other words, what he wrote. He said, I'm sure others would come along one day, and they will maybe pick up where I left off, or they will expand my vision, or maybe some of my theories will be outright refuted. Now, maybe that was also just Einstein being humble, because yet again, what we continue to find this long after his passing from this mortal realm is that so many of his theories were correct. The math was sound. These principles under general relativity hold true. And again, this is probably, at least for the time being, the most complete vision of the universe that we have. But then we get over into the quantum world, where the normal tenets of our space-time reality begin to break down. Things are quite different on the quantum level. And I'm always reminded of the late Sir Stephen Hawking saying that, you know, the best we may ever do is to have partial theories rather than that long-sought, grand, unified theory of the entire universe. And, you know, over the years, when it comes to the so-called paranormal, I've seen a lot of researchers argue that maybe we can find a grand unified theory that connects somehow UFOs and ghosts and Sasquatch and all this sort of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, perhaps there's no better way to do a disservice to the serious study of the unexplained than to try and say that these are all some sort of unified phenomena. You know, talking with Jeffrey Meldrum the other day, he said, part of the problem, I think, one of the great hindrances to being able to get academics on board with looking at the possibility, especially in light of the fact that the old single species hypothesis, that there can only be one dominant primate on Earth at any given time, well, we know that isn't true. That's not an accurate theory based on what we are seeing in the paleoanthropological record. Humans coexisted with and even interbred with Neanderthal, Denisovans. We see in the DNA of human populations today that there are other unrecognized hominins that we also interbred with and lived alongside during the last ice age. And so Meldrum said, you know, it's not uncommon if we're talking about primatology and if we're talking about human evolution. When we look back, it's actually more common at any time before the present day for humans to have coexisted alongside other hominins. And of course, we could talk all day about what happens when you have one particular dominant species rise to prominence like humans have and what that does to other species as a result of competition and the like. And hence why we think that humans rule the roost today and that we are the only dominant bipedal primate still in existence. But again, Meldrum says it shouldn't be, in terms of our evolutionary history, a hard concept to grasp that there could have been, up until fairly recently, others in our midst in remote corners of the world, or that maybe even a few in very rare instances could still exist today. Highly unlikely, though that is, it's not impossible. And yet, the few scientists who might be willing to look at that possibility are often turned off by the paranormal crowd. The people who get in there and say, well, we can't find Sasquatch easily, we have no body, therefore they must be some sort of paranormal entities, leaping through portals at Skinwalker Ranch. And then you begin to see some of the problems. Then again, of course, the paranormal advocates say, well, we don't care, this is our theory, this makes us feel good, it explains the phenomena for us, and we don't want the scientists involved because they're just skeptics and they don't like all this stuff. That's not true at all. Quite evidently, there are a lot of academics who are really interested in these topics, but it becomes more difficult for them to maintain that interest or to become involved publicly if there are, again, to put it mildly, more unusual theories that become associated with these subjects. But now to bring that back to Einstein, and again, this concept of a grand unified theory, you know, maybe what we don't need is a grand unified theory. maybe will actually benefit in our observations of the universe and our study of different physical models from utilizing those partial theories Sir Stephen Hawking talked about. But I get it. I know the physicists like to have a simple, elegant equation that explains a wide array of observable phenomena. Again, as far as that goes, for the time being, Einstein still rules the roost. And the guy continues to be so very right on so many observations he made. Really quickly, before we go to the break, emails coming in here. Martin writes, "Micah, I am a new listener of your podcast. I cannot express how much I enjoy your show. You are the most unbiased, fair, intelligent, informed, and well-spoken person I have ever heard on the subject of UFOs and any other subjects that you discuss. Plus, you're very interesting to listen to. It's easy to see that you have such a wealth of knowledge and detail to every show. Keep up the great work. Sincerely, Martin Rossi." Well, thank you very much, Martin. I hope you and yours are staying safe out there. Although, I have to say that your humble, your friendly neighborhood podcaster, yours truly, is only as good as the guests he surrounds himself with. And if you really want an intelligent perspective on UFOs, you're about to get one. Because when we come back after this, we will be joined by David J. Halperin, PhD, a religious studies professor, a scholar, and a man who's taking a Jungian psychological approach to the UFO mystery. We'll be delving into that when we return here on the Micah Hanks Program. I am Micah Hanks. Welcome back. Well, I am indeed pleased to be joined this week by quite a guest and someone who offers a very unique and fresh perspective on the subject of UFOs. David J. Halperin is a professor emeritus of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He trained in Semitic languages at Cornell University and Near Eastern studies at the University of California at Berkeley and in rabbinics at the Hebrew University at Jerusalem. He received his PhD from Berkeley in 1977. But here's what's of interest to us today. According to David's website, back in the 1960s, David was a teenage UFO investigator. Now retired from teaching, he lives in North Carolina, my own home state, with his wife Rose. He's the author of 5 nonfiction books on Jewish mysticism and messianism, which is a subject that interests me too. But he also wrote the coming-of-age novel Journey of a UFO Investigator and his latest book, which I really enjoyed reading over the last few days, Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFO. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Micah.
Yes, and thank you for reaching out. You know, I have told many of my colleagues in academia that one of the, you know, the upshots of this very unusual and scary time is that with everyone at home, I have had more opportunity to be in touch with folks like yourself and to read and to engage in intellectual discourse, even if we can't get out there and engage each other in the real world. So first and foremost, I hope you and yours are doing well down the mountain.
Thank you very much, Micah. We're doing great.
Yeah, and
hope the same for you.
Yeah, we're doing okay up here on the mountain, you know. Again, a little eye strain from all the reading and all the work on the computer, but those are small problems compared to what the rest of the world is seeing. So, you know, our hearts, of course, go out to everybody. You know, maybe I'll actually touch on that right here at the outset, because you had sent a article that you wrote for the Stanford Press blog, and of course, Stanford University Press being the publisher of your new book, where you touch on some of the COVID-19 stuff going on, and that in relation to people's interest in UFOs and really the state of affairs in the world today in general. What's your take on how things are going right now, being, of course, someone with a background and an interest in this topic?
Yeah, I mean, all of this is pure speculation, Micah. And we're going to have to wait and see how things develop. But I guess to give people a little bit of a background, I'm struck by the fact that UFOs first became a cultural phenomenon back in June of 1947. And that this was the same month that the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist first began to run the doomsday clock on their cover, that we were then 7 minutes to midnight, midnight being the extinction of the species through nuclear war. And one of the things I've argued in Intimate Alien is that there is a particular connection between UFOs and death, that they're in one way or another a symbolic representation of it. And it would make sense for them to become a cultural reality at a time when this new sort of death entered our world. Now, I've been puzzling for a while over why, starting out in 2017, UFOs have suddenly become respectable in all sorts of quarters that would not have taken them at all seriously before. The New York Times, which always looked down its collective nose at UFOs, now seems to be enthusiastically pro-UFO. So what's happening? And I can't help but connect it, and I admit this is very speculative, with the 2016 election. And with what that election brought across to us, that another sort of collective death is making itself felt in our consciousnesses, so that when the coronavirus pandemic broke out, when it began to penetrate my awareness that something huge and ominous was happening, I could not help but think that this is going to impact the UFO experience and what I call, without intending any disparagement, the UFO myth. And I published this in my blog post for the Stanford University Press. And then lo and behold, I read on your blog about the resurgence of UFO sightings in Belgium after 30 years. And I thought, yes, this is happening.
Yes, there seems to be, again, sort of a common theme, actually many, that emerge with interest in UFOs, especially around times of strife and concern. And this had been, again, going back to 1947, like you mentioned, one of those early interpretations before people began to say, hey, maybe there really is something here. The press largely downplays it, and they say, you know, it's war nerves. People are shaken up. We're concerned about whether or not we're going to go back to war, whether the new enemy in the East is behind something. Have they got new technology? Did they acquire it from Germany?
Yes.
Now, at this point in the conversation, I do think it's important to, and of course with respect to your work, to allow people to kind of know the approach and the angle that you take, because Intimate Alien is not another book about Roswell. Although you talk about Roswell a little in it, you talk about a lot of the great, you know, quote-unquote UFO cases, but I find your approach to be largely and also refreshingly skeptical, and you also apply a, I think it's fair to say, a Jungian psychological perspective to much of what we are dealing with. So maybe right here at the outset, let's also talk about your approach so that people understand why you're seeing this sort of, for lack of a better term, an eschatological or a kind of a doomsday aspect sometimes that people sort of attribute to UFO waves, flaps, and sightings.
Yeah. I stake out my position at the beginning of the book. I do not believe in UFOs, nor do I debunk them. I want to find a third way.
Mm-hmm.
The third way, and it will sound like a debunking statement, but I do not intend it as such, is that UFOs are a myth. I do not, however, use the word myth in its common sense to mean bunk, nonsense, falsehood, but rather something that is profoundly true, a kind of collective dream of our culture, of our species indeed, that reveals elements of us that we would otherwise not be conscious of. I see UFOs as visitors, not from outer space, but from inner space, which to me is as profoundly mysterious as the depths of the sky. And when we start having visitations from those inner realms, then attention must be paid.
Yes. You know, that's something that really fascinated me about your book is you look at the fact that, especially in the early days of ufology, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this a little later, but in those early days, there was a lot of looking below ground or an interpretation of whether or not UFOs might stem from within the Earth. Of course, this sort of bespeaks the famous Shaver mystery, Richard Sharp Shaver.
Absolutely.
Yes, which I found really interesting, too. I read a book a while back by Richard Rudgley, The Return of Odin, and he looks at the fascination humankind has with entering the Earth and descent down into caves and into the Earth, and the Jungian perspective on that. Actually, we might as well get into it right now, because, again, this idea, Yore Merkava, I believe, is...
Yes.
What you refer to, descenders to the chariot. Let's talk about that and some of those mythic sorts of overtones with relation to those inner earth mysteries in relation to early ufology.
Yes, the Yore Merkava were apparently, they are very, very mysterious, a group of Jewish mystics somewhere in the early centuries of the Christian era. We do not know when. There is an enormous literature devoted to trying to pinpoint them without so far too much success. But their aim seems to have been to replicate the vision of Ezekiel, described in the first chapter of his book, the vision that includes but is not limited to the wheels, which sound very UFO-like when he describes them. And these people called themselves the Yore Merkava, those who descend to the chariot being the collective term used in Hebrew for the entities that Ezekiel experienced. Now, why do you get there going down? You would think, I mean, Ezekiel sees the heavens opened and visions of God emerging from them. You'd think that if you were going to journey to Ezekiel's chariot, you would be going upward, and yet they speak of themselves as going down. No one has really explained that. To me, it's best understood as the idea of descent into the unconscious. And it interests me that some of the recollections of UFO abductees describe something parallel.
Mm-hmm.
We're going down. And the hypnotist, in this case, Bud Hopkins, the late Bud Hopkins, keeps trying to say, well, wait a minute, are you sure you're going down? You ought to be going the other way. No, we're going down. So I think there is something primordial that turns up both in the experiences of these ancient mystics and in what I think are the very real experiences of modern abductees.
Yes. You know, this is a great place, I think, to sort of reiterate both what you mean and I think the importance of understanding UFOs. And I'm going to actually borrow your term because I fundamentally agree with you on this. UFOs as a myth. Now, my father is actually, he's a religious scholar as well, and he's currently, he was supposed to retire this year, but he is still actively an Episcopal priest. And I've had him on the show in the past, and we've had conversations along these lines, and he had used the very same expression in the same way once. He had said that we look at a lot of these sorts of things, these modern myths, and someone had been offended by it because they said, why does he call them a myth? And my father retorts, well, why is myth a bad thing? And I think what we have to understand is that let's go out on a limb for a moment and say, and I think you would agree that at least some UFO incidents may represent something physical and tangible that we can't explain. I think you leave the case open, especially on the Socorro incident involving Lonnie Zamora, and maybe a few others. Others maybe not so much, but if we were to say that some of them do represent something physical and tangible, the problem is that we still don't know what they are. We do not know what the origin is. Let's just say it's an experimental government craft. Let's say it's somebody's, experimental technology that's being tested, but we don't have the complete picture. And what a UFO witness is left with, David, is, my gosh, I saw this incredible thing, and you add to this, of course, the known faculties of the mind, updating the memory and how memories change over time. By the time the person is describing the same incident, maybe 5-6 months later, 6 years later, all of a sudden, there's a very different layer of reality. They remember symbols on the side of the craft. They may remember
yes.
beings. They may remember hearing music. They may remember being the recipient of a telepathic message. Now, this may sound like nonsense to a real nuts and bolts UFO researcher, but you often, if you look at the lineage and the way that sometimes narratives are built onto UFO incidents, what happens at the outset and how the story evolves years later, you often see these sorts of things. And that's not to say people are liars, but I do think that, like you're drawing attention to with Ezekiel and with the ancient traditions, the Jewish mystic and also other world spiritualities applied to this, what we see is that there is something from within ourselves that often we project onto the unknown that is the UFO.
I could hardly think of a more nuts and bolts UFO researcher than Kevin Randall.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a fascinating piece in the International UFO Reporter, I suppose about 25 years ago, about two college students, a young man, and I think she was his girlfriend, although the relationship is not totally clear, who jointly witnessed a UFO coming down to Earth. Okay, now, Kevin was able to identify that UFO as an airplane landing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to start out with that fact that what those two young people witnessed was an airplane. The young man, although he didn't know what it was, he was able to describe it more or less accurately. But the young lady, within not years, but within a space of something like 48 hours, had transformed it into a domed disc in which she actually saw the occupants. so that we have almost a laboratory case there of something like what you described happening in a very short period of time. Now, to me, there is a tremendous mystery in this incident, not what was the object. Kevin established what the object was. It was an airplane coming in for a landing. But what was going on inside this young woman that transformed it in such a way? And to know that, we would have to explore all sorts of aspects of the sighting, which Kevin didn't get into. The one that to me is crucial is, what exactly was the relationship between the two young people? And in what way, how did their diverse memory of what they'd seen reflect what was going on in the relationship? I don't think that would provide the total answer, but I think that's the direction in which, let's say, the 21st century ufologist needs to go.
Yes. You know, recently I began a pretty deep study of ancient history in relation to strange things seen in the skies. And David, I won't make the argument that people were seeing flying saucers, you know, thousands of years ago, perhaps they were, but what is undeniable is that when things that people in ancient times could not explain appeared in the sky, celestial phenomenon, perhaps something along the lines of a sun dog, perihelion, you know, these kinds of things, which we understand very well today, but which the mind in that era did not. It is truly fascinating to look back and to see the levels of interpretation that are projected onto things, often religious, not always, most often yes. religious, I would yes. say. But again, it really kind of put into context for me that UFO studies are a whole lot more than just the idea that perhaps there are some technological craft of some kind buzzing around in our skies. It is really more about, and you actually put it very eloquently in your book at one point, saying that it's this sort of disconnect between what we see up there and what the mind perceives. But there would be no UFOs without an observer, would there?
I don't think so. And I think that the witness is an integral part of the sighting, as is the transmitter of the story, as is the debunker of the story, as is the audience for the story.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Coming over to Jung for a moment, you know, there was, I had never heard the story early in your book that you mention about Lindbergh.
Yes.
Going to visit Carl Jung and expecting to have, of course, this discussion about the psychology, like yourself, and you reference Jung's writing on flying saucers, a modern myth, he said, of things seen in the skies. I bought that book almost a decade ago, and I still have a copy. And, Lindbergh expects to have that conversation and is rather surprised to find that Jung is talking about the physical reality of UFOs and saying, well, you know, a completely myth-oriented phenomena doesn't have, you know, the ability to leave radar traces and things along those lines. I'd never heard that story.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating story, which, I mean, we only have it in Lindbergh's version. I don't know how Jung would have described it, but that Lindbergh quotes General Carl Spatz saying, you know, Slim, if there were these things flying around in the skies, don't you think we would have known about it by this time? And Jung says, there are things going on in the skies that you and General Spatz don't know anything about. And this is Hamlet's. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than dreamt of in your philosophy.
Oh, I love it. And I think that is fundamentally true, although perhaps the greatest mysteries are those that remain within us. We're talking with David J. Halperin. He is the author of the book, Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFO. We'll have information about where you can find that book linked in the show notes, and we will continue this conversation with him when we return. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Looking at the intimate side of the alien experience this week, our guest, David J. Halperin, PhD, religious studies professor, one-time UFO investigator, and now someone who is applying a very unique approach to the study of this subject, and one that employs heavily a Jungian psychological approach. And so again, I will remind the listener, I challenge you, in fact, especially those who approach this subject generally with a more nuts and bolts kind of attitude, we may learn something from looking at the more mythic aspect of the UFO experience. But David, I want to go back a little bit now, if you'll indulge me, to allow people to kind of understand the evolution of your own approach to this subject. Let's go back to your early days as a teenager, as a teenage UFO investigator, in fact, and how you became involved in the study and your interest, which has obviously remained a lifelong passion that you have for this subject.
I would say it was a lifesaver, that the central fact of my life as a teenager was that my mother was slowly dying of a heart condition, that I was an only child, that which was itself due to her having been sick even when I was born, that the three of us in our little Levittown house did not dare to talk about that reality, my father, my mother, and me. And it was as if we lived under an imposed silence. And then, when I was 12 years old, I read Gray Barker's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers.
Yes.
Which is a quite extraordinary book that I think is only in the past couple of decades beginning to get its due. And this book both validated and made sense of what I was going through, what was going on in my household, that what the book is about is the men in black, at first three men in black, and then they appear in different numbers in later parts of the book, who visit UFO researchers who've learned too much about flying saucers and silence them. This book was published in 1956, which is to say 41 years before the Men in Black made it to the movie screens.
Yeah.
But this is where they come from. And with that myth of the Men in Black, I felt I had a handle on what was going on in my household. I believed in the men in black because I knew them up close, and I believed in UFOs because I believed in the men in black, and I devoted my teenage life to trying to unravel the secret of the UFOs, which I think, I don't know for sure, but I think I expected might help forestall what I saw happening to my mother. Of course, it didn't work, but it kept me more or less sane and functional while I was doing it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate in you know, fairly simple terms to say that when you have something very troubling or something that is you know, very exhausting going on in your life, you know, the death of a loved one, relocation, you know, if you have a job that is very demanding, whatever it is that causes stress in your life, you know, again, to put it in very simple terms, everybody needs an escape, right? You got to get a hobby. Yeah. But I think looking more deeply, you know, at, for instance, And that's what I love about the first chapter in your book. You are looking at your own interest from your childhood and your teenage years, and you're realizing it played a deeper role. That escape mechanism, again, is very much a psychological coping mechanism and also something that can be instructive, getting a little Campbell-esque. Joseph Campbell often talked about the hero quest. I do think for a lot of UFO researchers or people who pursue the unexplained, it is a sort of hero's quest for them that I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to reveal the truth. I'm going to bring a new kind of unity, a sort of light to this, a light of truth to the world, a light of transparency. For them, it is very much a mythic quest put into a modern context.
I would agree with you totally. I would only hesitate a little bit to use the word escape, because I think it's less escape than a mode. And your other word, the other word you used, I would prefer, and that is coping, a way of getting a handle on a reality that otherwise can't be faced. The image I used in my book was that of the myth of Perseus and Medusa. Mm-hmm. If Perseus looks Medusa in the face, he'll be turned to stone, as I would have been turned to stone if I had looked my mother's impending death in the face. But if he uses a mirror, then he can grapple with it and eventually triumph.
Yeah, the mythic overtones to me are so evident throughout UFO stories. In fact, actually, you mentioned the three men in black that famously visited Albert Bender, and this really, I think, mythologized version of that story that is represented by the author you mentioned, Gray Barker, in his book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. At this point, before we kind of get more into, I think, some of the symbolism that is present in and really rife throughout UFO reports and sightings, maybe we can talk a little more about Gray Barker. You actually devote a tremendous amount of time to him in your book, and which I was very glad to see, because like you mentioned, a lot of his writing, sensational and entertaining though it was, didn't really get its due, and it was highly influential on belief systems and attitudes about UFOs, especially that concept of the so-called Men in Black, which, as you point out, that's not something that was new when it appeared in the UFO mythos. Let's talk about Gray Barker a little.
Yeah, let's. Where shall we start? He was born in 1925 in a town in West Virginia, a village in West Virginia, so tiny that it never appeared on the maps. He grew up in poverty. He had a hankering to be a writer, which he was able to fulfill through his writing for Fate magazine and eventually through the 1956 publication of They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. He also had a terrible secret of his own, mm-hmm. which was that he was gay. And I put terrible in scare quotes. Now we would not see it as such, but in West Virginia in the 1950s,
right,
this was something that had to be carefully guarded. So he knew, I mean, when Gray Barker, when he mythologized about the Men in Black, he knew them firsthand. They visited him every day to tell him, you must be silent. You must not let this get out. And this is what gave the book such power and authenticity. Now, I have to say that I do believe that Bender was visited by three men.
Uh-huh.
And not, I would say, at least 90%. At least 95% of what Barker describes in that book is real and true, or at very least is rooted in the earlier UFO tradition. He invented very little. in that book, but he gave it. He, by combining different elements, by very slightly shading certain bits of description, he gave it a mythic dimension from his own experience that could resonate 4 years later in the experience of a teenage boy confronted with a very different sort of terrible secret. And this was what was extraordinary about the man. He eventually died in 1984 at age 59 of what seemed to have been complications of AIDS.
He was, again, a very, almost an enigmatic character in all of this. And again, it really is important, I think, to point out, similar to how we might look at UFOs as being at times very physical, tangible things, these might be seen as a variety of different phenomena in nature, and also perhaps those that are more controlled, mechanical, perhaps, you know, and that may even include an airplane at times, as Kevin Randall pointed out. But the projected appearance, what we project onto them and what we interpret them as being thereafter, Bender essentially allows for the same thing to happen with the Men in Black. As you point out in your book, and you just said, you feel like Albert Bender was actually visited, but it had probably been people from the government, because as we are now seeing, you know, FOIA documents that are released about some of those early characters and personalities in the UFO movement, there was often a very religious kind of an angle. Many were putting together these gatherings. They were trying to reach out to the, you know, the Space Brothers. And the FBI had been concerned that this might be a front for communist subversive activities.
Yes.
And so it seems very plausible that Bender really did get a visit from somebody who might have been very concerned about his international organization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That he gave it the title, and he had some real organizational genius. Bender, I think, has been very much underrated in recent decades. He was an extraordinary man. And that he made this International Flying Saucer Bureau, as he called it, into a thriving, genuinely international organization. At some point, it was in August of 1953, the FBI got a hold of one of the business cards. They had visited Barker in his office, and they must have seen that International Flying Saucer Bureau and thought, aha, this is a communist front organization. We have got to get it shut down.
Yeah.
Which they did, apparently, by terrorizing Bender with some cock and bull story that he later came to realize wasn't true, but he got, by that time, he was so disgusted with the whole UFO subject, and besides which, he had fallen in love.
Yes, and when that happens, often one's interests tend to change, where they have a little less time for their old interests, huh?
yeah, that actually happened to me in my senior year of high school, that I had a girlfriend by then, and a great deal less time for my voluminous UFO correspondence.
That's right. Those kinds of things happen. But, you know, the other point, I think, that should be raised is that with the whole mythos of the Men in Black, and I've said that before as well, and again, people, their feathers get ruffled. Why are you calling it a myth? There are people who have actually had these experiences. Well, certainly, but I look back especially during the 1950s and 60s and some of the visits by the so-called Men in Black, which curiously didn't always wear black suits, and sometimes they introduced themselves, you know, as members of the Air Force, Office of Special Investigations, Blue Book Investigators, and things along those lines, you know, some of them even by name, like Richard French did. But we nonetheless have the continuation of the mythology that, well, even though they say they may work for the government, again, the writer John Keel, in his book, The Mothman Prophecies, he said this Richard French guy was an imposter. as are many people who claim to be representatives of the government investigating UFOs. Who are these people really, and where are they from? Well, in hindsight, we know Richard French really did work for the Office of Special Investigations, and very much like what you say about Bender, there was probably a real experience, but much like the UFOs themselves, we project this new reality onto it, that the men in black, whether or not they're dressed in black, represent something else, maybe even something alien.
Or indeed, something deadly.
Yes.
Because death comes dressed in black, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think that's what the man in black in the Maury Island story is. I don't know if we need to talk a bit about the so-called Maury Island mystery, but a man in black appears in that story, and I think he enters the story after the two Air Force officers who've come to Maury Island, who've flown out to investigate the supposed UFO sighting, which never happened, mm-hmm. after their airplane has crashed and they're both killed. And I think that he is a representation of death.
That's a really important point, because a lot of people maybe would hear UFOs, you know, being symbolic of or often associated mythologically with death or with danger. And people would say, oh, nonsense. But really, how often do you see UFO reports from that era, especially those which involve men in black, where there isn't an ominous or threatening overtone? What do the men in black do when they arrive at your door? They tell you, you don't talk about what you saw, and if you do, bad things will happen. There are threats made. Again, early on, Donald Kehoe and other writers on this subject, David, were driving home the point that, you know, you look at the Captain Mantell incident. We look back now, we think he may have been chasing a skyhook balloon, and he flew to an unsafe altitude, passed out, and then the plane crashes. But, I mean, UFO writers today still argue, no, it hadn't been a skyhook balloon and something else happened to cause the plane to disintegrate. Quite often there is this explicit association with death or danger in the early UFOs, and I think that continues today.
Well, if you ask yourself, what is the one most famous UFO story, the one that evokes name recognition in nearly everyone, and that is Roswell.
Yes.
And that is about death. And here is where I think a lot of skeptics are mistaken, in that they imagine that what the Roswell story is a fantasy of salvation coming from the skies. And I don't see that at all, that these UFO aliens are incapable of saving themselves, much less us, that the most powerful image of Roswell is the shattered craft, mm-hmm. and the childlike corpses within it, childlike both in the fragility, the smallness and fragility of their bodies, and in their outsized heads. And I would say we are those aliens. I mean, if you look closely at the Roswell stories, the so-called witnesses and the transmitters identify themselves with the aliens, because the aliens are us, frail, helpless children, confronting a fate that we can't understand and we can't ward off.
Yes, I think really you could even say that Roswell is almost like the blueprint, maybe the supreme archetype behind most of modern UFO investigation and research. We are talking with David Halperin. I want to get more into his perspectives on the mythology of Roswell when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. We'll be right back.
coming to you from the high mountains of Appalachia. I am Micah Hanks. Glad as always to be here with you. Glad to have our guest, Professor David Halperin, joining us to discuss his book, Intimate Alien. And the idea here, of course, is a very different approach to the study of UFOs than what we often see, what we often discuss even on this program. And that is all the more reason to have this discussion. You know, I'm not a fan of just talking with the people who agree with us all the time, or the people whose attitudes or ideas on any subject just conform to what we already believe. We have to challenge the way we think about things. I hope that this program in general challenges your way of thinking about things and causes us to rethink old ideas, to open our minds to new ones as we explore the universe. And of course, if you enjoy this show and you would like to show support for it and get a little something to show for that, if you head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast, you can sign up, become a X subscriber. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. That gets you not only this show, but also the weekly additional edition, the X podcast, and the monthly Enigmas specials. That's right, all on your own custom RSS feed. So just imagine all of the additional content you get, plus this show that you already know and love. So definitely consider showing support for the show, especially during these trying times. Please also don't forget that as the coronavirus situation ensues, every week we always feature links to stories that we discuss, links to author bios, books. We're going to have Dr. Halperin's book available in the show notes where you can find a link to that, and his website. But we also include links to coronavirus charities. And I really implore the listenership, please consider showing support and help in ways that you can. One of the charities that we feature there is No Kid Hungry. And with many children in America that rely on school lunch programs to be able to get a couple of good square meals in there each day, with so many parents now having to become teachers and educators, it's one of the reasons I think I've had so many educators, so many professors and scholars on the show recently. You know, we need our teachers, but there are teachers all over America right now with children having to stay at home. And these children, of course, need meals. They need food. They need support. They need love. They need attention. There's so much, but there's only so much we can all do. We nonetheless, of course, each play a part. And so definitely consider there in the show notes, either on your podcasting app or there at MicahHanks.com on the post that accompanies every episode. I've got those charities linked. Please consider showing some support too. We all have to come together in times like this. All right, so getting back to our wonderful guest. And again, Dr. Halperin, thank you so much for being with us here. I want to go in the direction of what you're talking about there, Roswell. Let's talk a little about the way that many of the elements that are presented in that story take on this extremely mythic kind of new reality when the story first breaks. Because, you know, I've actually got printings, reprints of the Roswell Daily Record right behind me on the wall here in my studio, David. The story as it first appears, you know, crashed disc, emptied, right? The next day, it's a weather balloon. And I'm sure it didn't help, of course, over the years, the fact that the Air Force did quite obviously change their story a few times. First, it was a disc, then it's a weather balloon, then it's Mogul many years later.
Yes.
So I'm sure some people say, well, if they lied that many times, what's to say that they aren't still lying? And hence, you know, again, the conspiracy continues. And again, I don't use conspiracy any more in a way intended to deride the subject than the idea of myth doing the same. Again, it is the contention of many that there is a cover-up or that there is a conspiracy involved. But if we look at the stages of development of Roswell, again, David, what do you see in the through the lens of mythology unfolding as this story changes and evolves?
Well, to begin with, that in the original reports on Roswell, there was not a whisper of alien corpses.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, the earliest source on Roswell, which was the announcement put out by Roswell Army Airfield on July 8, 1947, spoke of the disc as having landed, not crashed. That comes into it later on, that the public information officer issued this pronouncement that the many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence office of the 509th Bomb Group was fortunate enough to recover a landed disc. This was what was put out early in the afternoon of July 8th. Then the materials were flown out to Fort Worth to higher headquarters. And late in the afternoon, the higher headquarters announced that all of it was that it was just a weather balloon, and showed photographs of what obviously are the radar reflectors of the weather balloon, whereupon the story disappeared. I mean, everybody just decided, you know, just figured that this was the explanation and forgot about it. Jerome Clark, who was probably the most exhaustively knowledgeable historian of the UFO, the UFO tradition and experience, was able to find maybe one or two references to Roswell over the next 30 years in the UFO literature. Then in 1978, it blossoms again. I mean, this delay, this latency period, I think is a standard feature of the UFO tradition.
Yeah.
I'll say the UFO myth.
Sure.
I think I was shying away from that word, but I mustn't do that. And with the emergence of memories of Roswell came memories of the corpses in the disc. Also memories of people being shooed away by Air Force personnel. And one feature that comes up in a number of testimonies is that there was a team of archaeologists who were hovering from around the, I can't think of a better word than hovering, around the crash disk. They were from some Eastern university, probably the University of Pennsylvania. Now, that sounds like a wonderful clue to follow, and ufologists have followed it and have found absolutely nothing. And I am persuaded that the archaeologists are as much a part of the myth as the alien corpses, and their function is symbolic. Because what does an archaeologist do? An archaeologist gives voice to the silent dead.
Yes, or you might say also, pardon me for interrupting, but they might descend into the earth to remove truths from the...
Oh, nice. I hadn't thought about that. The theme of descent again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, we go down through the layers until we unearth the secret of the past.
Yes.
Which is the secret of our dead ancestors who never left written records, who were silenced in that sense. So here I'm seeing a myth that blossoms in 78, and clearly there was development between 1947 and 78, but it's all done in silence and darkness. It's almost impossible to trace those earlier stages of it. And the myth, as it comes out, is immensely rich.
Yes.
And immensely evocative.
Oh, yes. No, it is entirely that. And again, so many of these elements, I want to actually step over. I think this is a good place to do it, actually, too, because with the crash, the alleged crash at Roswell, what we are presented with is, by some accounts, the first representation, even though the story doesn't emerge until decades later, but it is sort of retrofitted to be a first reconciliation we have with the apparent presence of others, humanoid beings that resemble us, but which are distinctly alien. Now, I find that many have tried to sort of rewrite the Roswell story. You'll see images depicting the crash site, and you will see the popular alien gray, which may or may not be gray-skinned at all. At times they are, but again, what we're talking about quite obviously is the bulbous large head, the thin body, the extremely large wraparound black eyes, the small, barely protuberant nose, the thin, almost lipless mouth. This image is best represented and best known from the original cover of Whitley Strieber's book Communion, a book which was fundamentally, I mean, I actually think it's safe to say, David, it was tremendous when it arrives on the shelves and the effect that it had. That book sold largely on, I think, this strange almost desire that erupts in one when they see that book. It's both fear, it is also intrigue, it is interest.
Yes.
When people see that image of something so human-like and yet not, they are almost called to by that. Now, what does this have to do with Roswell, apart from the fact, of course, that we're talking about what an alien looks like? The original Roswell bodies, and you touch on this in your book, Kevin Randall and others have written about this over the years, they didn't necessarily bear all those qualities. Small eyes that were strangely placed or spaced, rather. There are. Let's talk about some of those differences, and then I want to get over to discussing Strieber's alien.
Yeah, well, I think I would just as soon start with Strieber's alien. That
sure.
This is something that's really very hard to grasp, that now that face has become canonical as the face of the UFO alien, that it did not exist before 1987, which is what January 87, which is when Strieber's book came out with that cover painting by Ted Jacobs. And before that, I mean, you could, Patrick Weig has collected images of UFO aliens. There was nothing like that prior to the appearance of Strieber's book. But that book evoked a recognition response in thousands and thousands of people, as if they saw that and said, yes, I have encountered beings like that before. Now, my own story of recognition response comes from, it was in 2013, I think, that I gave a lecture on UFOs at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and I showed, as part of a PowerPoint presentation, I showed the cover of Strieber's book, and a year and a half later, an old friend of mine who was teaching at UNCG emailed me, saying, I saw a face just like that in Maria Gimbutas's book on the prehistoric art of Kosovo.
Uh-huh.
And he sent me a photo, a scan of the image from Gimbutas's book from about 5,000 years ago. And it's not quite identical with what Ted Jacobs painted at Strieber's description. But it is very close to it, so close that this man who had no interest in UFOs apart from our friendship was that when he saw it in Gimbutas's book, he remembered it after a year and a half. Now, to me, this is an indication that there is something primordial, and I'll use the Jungian word archetypal, about that face, which is simultaneously prehistoric and also an innovation of Strieber's book. There's a paradox there that I think runs through the UFO tradition, that we're dealing with modern myths whose origins can be pinpointed sometimes to a single day, that are nevertheless primordial, that have antecedents in ancient or medieval or early modern literature or art.
That paradox that you're touching on there, David, I think that is best represented perhaps with the sort of culture of belief that's been built around the ancient astronaut or ancient alien idea. And by the way, for anyone who's interested, I believe it's the pre-Dionica mask of Kosovo that Gimbuta you feature an image of this in your book Intimate Alien. I recommend that people at very least Google that, but of course we want you to also buy the book and to read this. It's well worth the read. But I've seen similar imagery, again, being an archaeological enthusiast myself, I've seen similar imagery in other parts of the world too, particularly from Mesoamerica, the wraparound eyes, the slanted kind of ovoid eyes. the ancient astronaut theorist would say, well, this quite obviously means that these aliens have been here since time immemorial. They've been visiting, they've been interacting with humankind. I've always been more of the mind that, well, but if this is a phenomenon, that at least part of it stems from within us, this is an image we recognize for something far, for reasons far less tangible than alien visitation, which would perhaps explain the continuity and the multicultural presence of similar imagery going back to ancient times. And yes, I think that whatever that is, it strikes hard. It strikes something within us. And that, I think, is in part what really sold the idea of communion, which, again, we have to point out, you do in your book, I've often argued this, I've met Whitley Strieber, he never explicitly said in that book, I was being abducted by aliens, I saw the UFO, it was hovering right there. He always tried to approach it with a degree of separation from conclusions. You know, he put forth a lot of ideas. He had said, you know, perhaps time travelers, you know, from the future, perhaps they are something, you know, perhaps these are our ancestors in some way. He went through all these different modes of thought about what this was and never, ever definitively said this is what it was. And yet he was pegged immediately as a extraterrestrial alien abductee. I remember him going on Larry King's show and saying, I never said these were aliens. I don't see why saying this experience makes me an unreasonable person. I think he was actually tapping into something that many more people have experienced than you would think.
I mean, he was, Strieber was incredibly self-aware. I mean, and he was perfectly aware of all these things we're talking about. In communion, he describes the eyes of his visitors, that was his term for them, as the huge staring eyes of the ancient gods.
Yeah.
So he knew very well the antecedents of what he was experiencing. And he also was willing to consider certain less flattering interpretations of his experiences, such as that he had been sexually abused as a child. And indeed, it's very hard, very difficult to read some of his descriptions without thinking, my God, this poor boy.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody did something awful to him that is now surfacing in different form. Strieber himself was quite aware of that and entertained it in the book.
Yes. Before we go in that direction, it is a controversial direction, but I mean, more broadly speaking about the abduction phenomena, one, in my opinion, and I'm very glad that I saw you addressing this in your book, one cannot escape the unfortunate connection, but the reality that there is one between the abduction phenomena and memories of sexual abuse. So we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yes.
I do want to add one more beautiful interpretation, though, that because, again, Whitley Strieber, I think many people misunderstand in a lot of ways what he was saying. I actually find Communion to be a beautiful book. I've met Whitley and spoken with him at length on one occasion. He actually he interviewed me for his program, which is, it's usually the other way around. You expect to interview him, and being able to talk with Whitley was very interesting. I still have a whole lot of respect for him and his writing, and frankly, he's just a really great writer. I mean, if you read his books, ladies and gents, you don't have to believe in UFOs to enjoy the hell out of what he writes. But Whitley also introduces the idea, what if these experiences are what evolution looks like as we're experiencing it? That was one of the most profound ways of wording this entire thing that I have ever read. And again, if nothing else, as a thought experiment, Communion remains a fantastic book. But David has touched on something that I think is arguably one of the most controversial aspects of the UFO phenomena, especially as it relates to abductions. We're going to get into that with him in the next portion of the conversation. It is the Micah Hanks Program. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Our guest this week, David J. Halperin, PhD, religious studies professor, now retired, and also, as he confesses on his website, a one-time UFO investigator. In fact, he still has a lot to say about this subject, although from a very different perspective, perhaps, than that which he offered in his youth. And I find his perspectives very meaningful today. Now, before we went to the break, we were getting around to discussing a very controversial aspect of the UFO phenomenon, especially as it relates to abduction. And I really feel that it warrants discussion here. It should be discussed. I think that it is something that is a sensitive issue, but it must be approached ethically and carefully. But it should be discussed, not only because I think it is important in terms of helping people cope or reconcile with experiences that they have had, but it also addresses other important issues that we face in our society. Now, you mention in the book at one point, one thing that is evident when you're reading Communion is sexual abuse practically cries out to the reader from the printed page. I'm quoting you there.
Yes.
You mention also a short story that he wrote that involved this idea of abuse. One of his other novels involves a little boy who is kidnapped by a torturous maniac, and the kid is trapped in this torture dungeon below the house and is trying to escape and does. And I had always wondered, there are always these themes of a young child who is in a dangerous situation trying to escape. It definitely had caused me to wonder, you know, are we seeing something that has more to do with perhaps, you know, repressed memories or a childhood trauma? And could that be represented in other areas of abduction literature? Now, if you'll forgive me for jumping into a story here, but I must share this. I think you'll find it interesting for your own research as well. I spoke with a young lady, we'll call her Anna, had no interest in UFOs whatsoever. I had been investigating the topic at that time, and as an experiment, my colleague Chris says, Anna's going to drop by, and he says, you know, just as an interesting experiment, why don't we ask Anna about extraterrestrial abduction? Because he said, I happen to know, since she has discussed very openly that when she was young, she had been a victim of abuse. As tragic as that is, of course, she has come to terms with it, but the point is not to bring that up. I'm just interested in seeing if she has any interest at all in the idea of alien abductions. And so she arrives and we sit down, we're all having coffee, and she says, how are you, Micah, and how have you been? And I say, well, you know, I've been researching alien abduction recently. And her eyes kind of widen and she says, oh, really? And I said, yeah, is that any interest of yours? And she said, not really. I've never really read about UFOs, but I did have an abduction experience once. And of course, Chris and I look at each other and we said, oh, okay, and how did this occur? And she said, well, I was in a car accident. And she said, let me be clear, I knew I was not being abducted by aliens. I had been in a car accident and I was in shock. But they had to airlift me out of the vehicle. And as they were doing so, the doctors had to cut portions of my clothing. Fortunately, she wasn't injured or anything. But she said, during the entire experience of them airlifting me out of the vehicle, she said, I saw aliens. There were aliens. You could not have convinced me it wasn't an abduction experience. And I was fighting. I punched one of the doctors who was trying to, you know, insert an IV and help me. I said, Anna, what were the aliens trying to do? And she said, they were trying to cut my clothes off of me and sexually assault me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At that moment, David, it hit me. I thought, you know, I don't think I can deny any longer that there's a connection here, as you elaborate on in your book as well.
Yeah. Now, what we have to insert a caveat here, Mike. And that is that the whole idea of repressed memories of sexual abuse has fallen, let us say, into great disrepute. It was widely accepted in the late 80s and perhaps the beginning of the 90s, and then there was a severe backlash against it, so that I think it's hard to mention it now without people rolling their eyes in disbelief. In my own view, the backlash was excessive and exaggerated. I think it is true that innocent people were often put through horrible ordeals on the basis of spurious or more likely distorted memories.
Right.
But it seems to me that the skeptics have gone way too far, and they've ignored what seem to me some pretty clear cases of memories of sexual abuse, accurate memories being repressed and then emerging. So yeah, I really do think, and the story you tell of Anna, I think is a great example of that. I really do think that there is a considerable correlation between actual sexual abuse, which everybody concedes takes place, and the experience of abduction.
Yes.
At the same time, if we're going to use that as an interpretive tool, we've got to anticipate a fair amount of flack from people who will ridicule both and use the one to damn the other.
Right. You know, if I may interject, I think part of the issue is, and again, I've been someone who's studied pretty deeply what I think are cultural corollaries to the abduction phenomena. One of those is the belief that some people have been super soldiers, Manchurian candidates that were programmed to carry out activities by government agencies or other organizations. And that through, here again, here's going to be the introduction of the continuity. Through hypnosis, they are able to access their memories of being programmed to be the Manchurian candidate. Another example is more akin to what you're describing, David, the so-called satanic panic. It wasn't often in the 1980s and 90s just alleged repressed memories of sexual abuse. And in fact, one might argue, I know in the case of Anna, there was no repressed memory. She had full memory of the family member that had, and again, quite obviously why I withhold her name, but the experience that she'd had and the abuse that she had suffered, which is, you know, a tragic circumstance under any conditions. You don't always have a repressed memory. Sometimes it is remembered. And the unique thing about her experience was that she also didn't believe in UFOs or have an interest in that, but she clearly remembered this invasive, and I think that's what it is, the extraterrestrial abduction and experimentation is this ultimate intrusion, this ultimate kind of a invasion, often quite literally penetrative. If we think about Betty Hill, there is a needle that is inserted
yes.
in.
Yes.
And so there is this ultimate invasion or intrusion or penetration. Yes, quite obviously there are sexual, overtones here, because I think that there is at times a component. Now, I also don't think that all people's claims of encounters with extraterrestrials, or at very least the occupants of UFOs, I don't think that they're always necessarily sexually related or always necessarily involved with past trauma of any kind. I'm merely saying that this is something many researchers have touched on. Bud Hopkins' former lover, the writer Carol Rainey, had written a yes. fantastic article about this, which you may have read, and she had noted, you know, it became evident to us that virtually all of the people that Bud was talking with who had said that they had had extraterrestrial encounters, abduction experiences, etc., she said the majority, if not all, had also been past victims of childhood trauma or sex abuse. And so again, I'm actually merely acknowledging what other researchers have pointed out, and I don't think that that's something that can easily be denied. But again, to your point, the fact that people have become very skeptical of it, I think, is in part due to its association with the satanic panic, which was a broader belief that there were satanic organizations that were perpetrating these acts of abuse. And further, that this information could be recovered through hypnosis, which many scientists, and rightly so, they look at that as being a pretty flimsy way of accessing these informations, especially with the idea that the introduction of a false memory can occur at that time. And I think that's where we have to say not all people are experiencing repressed memories per se, but that element was associated with this also very concerning so-called satanic panic. And I think that's where the kind of disconnect occurs.
I have a story of my own to tell you about that.
Yeah, please.
Which is that in 1995, I gave a paper before the American Academy of Religion on UFO abductions and traditional stories of heavenly ascent, in which I suggested in rather bolder terms and more unilateral terms than I'm apt to do now, that UFO abductions are indeed distorted memories of sexual abuse. The paper created quite a sensation. I remember the moderator of the panel had to at one point say to the audience, now, does anyone here have any questions for anyone other than Professor Halperin?
Oh.
And I was encouraged to submit it to the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, which I did the following year. I got back a rejection letter accompanied by one evaluation. Normally, the practice in academia is to send an article to two evaluators. The editor had sent it only to one, who responded, I assume this paper is a joke.
Huh.
If it is serious, the author should be subject to prosecution for criminal malpractice.
What?
Now, would, I mean, of course, I was a bit shocked by this. And when I said to the, I wrote to the editor, I said, look, I want another reading of this paper. This man is obviously biased and it was obviously triggered something in him. The editor refused. To me, this is evidence that I had hit a nerve.
What about your paper, though, would have been likened to criminal malpractice? I mean, first of all, are you a practicing psychiatrist administering to patients? I didn't think.
Of course not. Of course not. But that it evoked such visceral rage in this reader that he hurled at me whatever threat he could find, which to me and my more sober reflection on it is evidence that I was on the right track.
Well, you aren't the only one who has made that argument, and so I would again look at that as further evidence that, yes, you were seeing something, you were spotting a pattern that a lot of researchers have acknowledged. And again, I want to be very clear. If I were to give an example of a potential incident that involved a quote-unquote UFO captive, and there are some elements of this case that are intriguing to me which don't necessarily scream extraterrestrial, but again, the Travis Walton abduction, which he actually says it wasn't an abduction. He says, I ran out under this aircraft. The aircraft appears to have grounded, and this electrical discharge zapped me. He said they picked me up to make sure I wasn't injured. It was a rescue mission, not an abduction. And the quote-unquote aliens he described on board, although he had had some kind of, you know, blurry recognition of seeing something in the room with him when he initially awoke. And I think that we might argue that there's potential there, if he's in a state of shock, for certain mythologization to occur. You know, he doesn't see clearly who's in the room with him, and he therefore interprets aliens. But after that point, he explicitly describes seeing people. He said they were just like you or I. They were the epitome of their gender. They were wearing these sorts of blue jumpsuits, but they looked like people, not like extraterrestrials. There are aspects of the case that are interesting to me, but again, with that one as an example, I would say maybe certain instances of, you know, alleged contact with the occupants of UFOs absolutely represent some sort of a physical, tangible experience. Now, I don't know if you would agree with that, but I look at Travis's. I've met him. I'm interested in that case, and I wouldn't say, oh, he's got repressed memories or something, and that's what this experience represents. It is merely, though, to say that if not all cases, at least some do seem to have this other element, a psychological component, as you've outlined. And as, again, I reiterate, I'm glad that you address it in the book and that so many others have, that I think is undeniable. And if, again, what is criminal about trying to help people understand the nature of their experiences and perhaps come to a better sense of harmony with themselves and perhaps also come to a point where they can better cope, to use that term again, with past experiences and traumas? We are trying to look at ways that people can be aided in coping, I think. And in truth, in that way, one might see at times the abduction experience or belief in it as part of a coping mechanism, which you could argue, David, maybe they should be allowed to cope. Maybe they should be allowed to have that experience.
Don't think we can stop them. And I mean, your story of Anna is, I think, tremendously important in that we would have to ask, why did the alien abduction, let's say, scenario become the template to which she reverted.
Yes.
That and that she did not believe in UFOs or abductions, at least consciously, to me sharpens the importance of that question. I would infer that there is something very powerful in this, very powerful within us, that responds to that scenario.
Yes. Yeah, there is something deeper at times that, again, it's this sort of longing, I think, in a way, for the other, or it is a fear of the other, or it is, you know, a fear of intrusion, or it is a, you know, any number of other things. But I think we have to recognize that perhaps, again, for the nuts and bolts UFO researcher who may be listening and saying, you know, I just don't buy this. I'm looking at flying saucers and things that you can photograph, things that have been filmed, you know, things that the U.S. Navy may have gotten on film. Even apart from that, again, there is what appears in a blurry video, utilizing, interestingly, some of the best tracking technology that we now possess. There's whatever that object is, and then there is what we assign to it. And try to understand in the context of what David presents, how the mythology and the idea of how something becomes mythologized is an important aspect to UFO research, no matter how we approach it. Our guest is David Halperin. We will continue this conversation with him when we return. I am, of course, your host, Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, concluding our conversation this week with Dr. David Halperin about his book, Intimate Alien. And this is, I tell you, quite a conversation. Yet again, I hope that the listener, especially those who approach the topic generally from a more nuts and bolts perspective, have been perhaps challenged by what we've discussed this week. And before we wrap up, David, I want to get into a little discussion, actually go back in time, and look at a particular case that you outline in the book that has direct relevance to your other line of work, religious studies. I was really, really surprised at how similar one of the aspects in particular of this case we're about to discuss had been to some of the more modern UFO encounters, particularly those related to Men in Black. And that, of course, involves the account given in 1683 by Abraham Cardozo. Let's talk about that.
Okay, Abraham, let's see, I don't want to clutter up with too many background details, but let us say that Abraham Cardozo was a follower of a messianic movement in the late 17th century associated with the figure of Shabbatai Tzvi. Shabbatai was a Jew from Izmir in what's now Turkey, who claimed to be the Messiah and who was believed in by what was probably a majority of the Jews of his time. He was going to redeem the Jewish people, lead them back to the Holy Land, and then in 1666, he abruptly converted to Islam. And at which point most stopped believing, but there were some who tried to maintain some sort of faith in Shabbatai Tzvi, and one of them was a man named Abraham Cardozo, who had been brought up as a Catholic in Spain, originally of a Jewish family, and had, as an adult, left Spain and converted to his ancestral Judaism. And he worked out an amazing theology, which We could have a whole show on Cardozo's theology, but that's, I think, not where we want to go now. And at one point in 1683, he had an experience that he and some friends were in their garden, and they looked up to the moon, and they saw that the moon was strange. And I use the word strange because I think initially Cardozo didn't quite know what he was seeing till his friends helped him, that there were four people on the moon, one woman and three men. And the three men, whose voices they could hear from the moon, descended into their garden. Then they visited Cardozo in his rooms, discussing theology with him. And at first Cardozo thought they were blessed ghosts. But when they began to speak, it gradually became clear to him that they were demons who were trying to seduce him into heresy. And he called down, called the God whom he worshipped, the God of the Bible, whom they mocked. He called on God to send fire to consume them. Horribly, the one who got burned up was not them, but Cardozo, who took to his bed with what he called fiebre ardiente, burning fever, while these three men, dressed in black clothing, stood by his bed. And when he said to them, "How long will you keep on tormenting me?" they responded, "Until you are dead, for it is our God's pleasure to do to you as your God did to Pharaoh." Eventually, Cardozo banished them. He says, "Go off to Salonica. There is nothing here for you now." And they do leave, and he recovers. But what I get out of that story is that the three men in black were around 270 years before they visited Albert K. Bender in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And I know, by the way, that the Gray Barker wasn't drawing on that story when he wrote they knew too much about flying saucers, because Barker didn't know Hebrew, and that story was not translated into English until 2001, when I translated it for an anthology of Cardozo's writing. And you know, when I was studying Cardozo, I wasn't wearing my ufologist hat.
Right.
And this just popped out at me. Here is an experience of, yeah, I would call it a UFO, an unidentified flying object, the moon that isn't the real moon, because the moon really does not hover so close to your garden that you can hear people's voices from it.
Right.
And that they can come right down. Cardozo knew that perfectly well. Even back in the 17th century, you know, we didn't know the exact distance of the moon, but people knew that it was many thousands of miles away. So there is some sort of an unidentified celestial object with a quaternity of entities, and we can talk more about that. I'm using the Jungian term for a foursome of which one is somehow different from the other three. Yes. And the entities that torment the man who has seen too much come dressed in black. I wrote in the book that we realized that Albert Bender was lucky to come out of his encounter with the three men in black with nothing worse than an upset stomach. Cardozo nearly died.
Yeah.
So once again, we've got this paradox of the UFO myth as being both old and new. Gray Barker created the myth of the three men in black, on the basis of what I think were real experiences of Albert Bender. And it wasn't for another 40 years that they became a common cultural property. But centuries before Barker, they were part of what, and I'll come out as a Jungian here, call our collective unconscious.
Yes.
And I think that's what the UFOs are. That's where they come from. Jung saw that, and I would see him as the pioneer of this approach to a very real and very important phenomenon.
Let's talk for a minute about the quaternity that you mentioned there, especially as it relates to Cardozo's experience, but this idea borrowed from Jungian concepts involving the three and the one, which creates the quaternity. He would see this in all kinds of things, symbolic representations, but you notice it an awful lot in UFO sightings too, which I think is actually significant.
Well, you had a whole show on the Belgian sighting, and that was the standard form, right?
Right, yeah, the three lights.
Three white lights and one red light.
Yeah.
And in the very famous and I think very impressive case of William Booth Gill in 1959, foursomes crop up all over the place. Now, why the foursome? Why so much of our psychic life is structured around the foursome? By the way, not only psychic. I mean, some have pointed out that the baseball diamond is a quaternity.
Mm.
The three bases and then home base, one of the collective rituals that we venerate as sports. But it does seem to be real. I mean, one of Jung's most interesting ideas was that the Christian Trinity is a mutilated quaternity. And that is the great flaw of the Christian religion, that it cut out the fourth.
Right.
Fourth being either the devil or Mary.
Yes. Yes. And in the instance with Cardozo, what we appear to see is the three men in black, but what else? There, yes, the woman on the moon.
Oh, the woman. Yeah, who's that woman? And here we've got to go to another dimension, which is much more conventionally historical, that I told you that Cardozo was brought up as a Catholic in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And a colleague of mine years ago, who was an expert on Catholicism, I asked him, does the Catholicism have the image of a woman on the moon? He said, of course, the Virgin Mary standing on the moon.
Right.
And she's often accompanied by three angels. So here's another dimension to Cardozo's experience. I've tracked it. You know, he came from a town in Spain called Medina de Rio Seco. And you go to the church of the Medina de Rio Seco, where Cardozo must have worshipped as a child, and you see the woman standing on the moon.
Yeah.
He must have seen that. And that must have erupted in his hallucinatory experience in 1683, by which time he'd come to be convinced that what the Catholics called the Blessed Virgin was in fact a she-devil.
Right.
Okay, so that's part of, if we're understanding his vision, his experience, we've got to bring in the art historical component. We've got to bring in the depth psychological component. And I think that's what we've got to do with UFOs. They're a very complicated collective dream that fuses different layers of meaning.
Yes. Where can folks find out about you? I know you've got a lot of information online on your website, your blog, and also other books that you've authored.
Well, I guess the first place would be the website, www.davidhalperin, as one word. That's D-A-V-I-D, H-A-L as in Leon, P as in Peter, E-R-I-N.net. And then as the author of a new book, I will naturally hope that many of your listeners will choose to check out my book. And they can do that. They can find it either via my website or go directly to the Stanford University Press website, or else they can, in these very trying times, give their support to a wonderful local independent bookstore, Flyleaf Books. And I think the web address is www.flyleafbooks.com/intimatealien as one word. But if that doesn't work, then just Google Flyleaf Books Intimate Alien and it will come up. So all of these are ways they can find out more about my ideas and my work, and they can contact me through my website, and I will be delighted to hear from any of your listeners.
Well, as I was delighted to hear from you, already familiar with your work, it was truly a surprise and a joy to see your message pop up. And I have really enjoyed this conversation. I hope it won't be the last one that we have. In fact, I invite you to keep in touch, and let's definitely do it again, okay?
Oh, I would like to very much, Micah. Thank you so much for having me.
And again, thank you to Dr. David Halperin. His website, one more time, davidhalperin.net. The book is Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFO. I think some of the perspectives he brings to the conversation are very, very important. That may be especially the case for those of us who generally look at this phenomenon as potentially being more nuts and bolts. From time to time, we need to see the deeper reality. And as I pointed out, and as David expresses throughout his book, really the one consistent element when it comes to UFOs is that if there weren't people to see them, there would be no UFO phenomenon. All right, that'll be the final word on this week's edition of the program. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah, are Race Hobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Stephanie Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks. And on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.